Welcome to Canon and Culture, a podcast of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. I'm Matthew Hawkins. Joining me from the Middle East is my colleague and friend Travis Wousseau. Travis serves as the ERLC's first ever Director of International Justice and Religious Freedom. Travis, welcome to Canon and Culture.
Hey, thanks.
Let's get into what is it that you do in the ERLC's Justice of International Religious Freedom, or rather, let's back up a little bit and talk about the creation of the Office of International Justice and Religious Freedom.
Yeah, the office really, the idea for it came, you know, over the course of several months of discussions between Philip Bethencourt and I about what ERLC has been doing internationally and what the possibilities might be to have somebody located in the Middle East, somebody focused on it full time. And, you know, what might the possibilities be to really extend ERLC's capacity on these issues? Because, of course, you know, ERLC has been involved in international religious freedom for many, many years. So this is not really a new area of work for ERLC. But, you know, those discussions with ERLC were happening at the same time that my family was thinking about moving overseas. And it just was a great fit. And so that's kind of how it came to fruition. That was about a year ago. It's hard to believe that it's almost been a year, but it has. And in terms of, you know, in terms of the work that we do, obviously the international office's work is tightly integrated with ERLC's operations in DC and in Nashville. But the way I describe our work is that it kind of falls into three categories. We equip, mobilize, and advocate. So we're equipping pastors.
Your vantage point. Let's back up a bit and talk about life before you and you moved your family from Texas to the Middle East. Prior to joining the ERLC as Director of International Justice and Religious Freedom, you were already doing some legal assistance for us, reviewing some legal documents and amicus briefs and all that kind of work. What were you doing at the time in Texas prior to joining the ERLC full time?
Yeah, you know, I'm a lifelong Texan. I'm actually an eighth-generation Texan,
you're one of those.
I know, I'm sorry. My daughters are ninth-generation Texans.
And you're very proud of that, aren't you?
I mean, I don't want to brag, but...
I got to branch out. My podcast guest selection has steered into a rut with all you Texans. Bethencourt was on the last one.
Oh, that's funny.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, continue.
I grew up in the Dallas area. I went to the great University of Texas for undergrad and for law school. And I stayed in Austin and practiced law for several years before ultimately joining the staff of the church that I've been going to, all through undergrad and law school, which is the Austin Stone Community Church. I was a energy lawyer. I did a little bit of legislative and policy work. And when I joined the staff of the Austin Stone, I focused on equipping and leadership development, and ultimately served as one of the executive pastors there for several years. And 2 years before we moved to the Middle East, I had started doing some work with the ERLC. Philip Bethencourt and I had become friends when he was at Southern with Dr. Moore. And so when Dr. Moore became president of the ERLC, you know, as you mentioned before, you know, I started doing some work with ERLC, mostly on a legal front. And what we were kind of going through at that point, and what I was going through at that point in my life was trying to figure out how to bring the two threads of my career or my life, maybe that is law and ministry, how to bring those two things together. And my time consulting with ERLC, you know, proved, you know, to really just be the starting point. And, ultimately, you know, as I mentioned kind of at the top of the podcast, you know, we, you know, Philip and I, you know, had conversations over several months about, you know, what it would look like, to, you know, to start an international office for ERLC. So that's kind of how we got here. I'm married, as I mentioned a minute ago. I've got two ninth generation, Texan daughters named Maggie and Jane. My wife and I, we met at the University of Texas. I was actually her TA in a business class. We didn't you know, there was no scandal. We didn't start dating until several years later. But that was where the seeds of our love for each other were sown. And she, her background is in finance and large scale infrastructure management consulting. And so she's taken that experience to where we are, and she's doing some economic development work, particularly with a focus on women-owned businesses and, you know, small businesses here. And, you know, we're, you know, it's hard to say, you know, you never know, you know, in the moment, you know, how you're actually doing in terms of adjusting to culture shock. But, you know, we've been here for almost a year. I mean, I think we're doing pretty well. You know, are you know, learning, you know, learning language and you know, I think we're doing pretty well.
Yeah. Any particular challenges that you witness among your family and your team in the Middle East over the last year? What have you guys had to overcome just kind of in daily life?
Yeah. I mean, I think you know, where we're living now is an urban setting, you know, we Texans really like our space, and so you know, and so I think to some extent, you know, some of the biggest adjustments, you know, have been adjusting to a new sort of mode of life, you know, but of course there's cultural adjustments as well. You know, you you know, Arab culture is so warm and inviting, and, you know, also confusing. You know, there, you know, you have to learn, you know, basically a whole new, you know, sort of set of code language. It's funny. A friend of mine was just asking me today. She's kind of in the expat community. She's a German lady, and she was saying, okay, so I have a question about you Americans. When you say we should get together, do you mean it? And, you know, and I thought
I'm not sure most Americans know that.
Yeah,
know
I was
that.
Like, well, sometimes, but sometimes not. You know, you kind of have to be able to, you know, you kind of have to be able to understand the secret language of, right. You know, whether it was a sincere, do you want to get together, or I'm just trying to end the conversation in a nice way. Would you like to get together? Right. You know, and every culture has their own secret language like
sure.
that. And so, you know,
it's astute of her to know to ask that question.
it was pretty funny. I immediately remembered all the times that we had told her that we were going to have them over, and haven't followed through. So it wasn't clear to me if she was talking about us or another American family. But, anyway, but yeah, I mean, in general, I mean, I would say, you know, we talk to a lot of people from back home who, you know, are worried about our safety, or, you know, so sorry for us about all the sacrifices that, you know, we've had to make. And, you know, the fact is, I just feel every day, you know, we are the ones that have the blessing here. And, you know, mm-hmm. it's truly a privilege to get to live where we live and, you know, and make friends with people who are nothing like us and who we never would have met. And, you know, you learn a lot about yourself too, living in a culture where you are totally an outsider. So, you know, we feel honestly, richly, richly blessed by this whole experience.
And, would you care to share what the experience of your children have been like? How have they adjusted?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, they're both at an international school, and so it's funny to hear, you know, some of the words that they come home, you know, saying, whether it's, you know, it sounds like British English or, you know, something else. But I think my daughter said the other day she wanted loads of candy, which you know, just not, she didn't learn that from us. I can tell you that. But they're, you know, they're doing really well. I mean, it's interesting to see, you know, to see the world through their eyes. And, you know, to watch, you know, even from like the kinds of dress up, you can tell them a dad to daughters, but the kind of dress up that they want to wear at home is very Middle Eastern now, you know, you know, they put, you know, they want to cover their hair. And so, you know, it's interesting to see that, you know, to see that, impact, but, you know, no matter where you are in the Middle East, I mean, it's, you know, things are tense here. And, you know, one of the things that we're kind of always wondering is how much, you know, how receptive of that tension are they? But I think, you know, and I think by and large, you know, they take their cues from us. And, you know, I can tell when I'm nervous, then they're nervous. But when we're not nervous, you know, they don't seem to notice, you know, all the machine guns, and whatever. So it's very interesting to see, you know, to see the world through their eyes, because they don't notice some of the things that really freak us out. And I think it, you know, in some ways is a, you know, it's like a reminder that maybe we ought not be so scared ourselves, you know. Not, which isn't, I don't want to paint a picture that we spend our whole lives freaked out or scared.
Right.
You know, we certainly don't, but
yeah. Well, I think you reflect the natural impulse of what particularly Americans and maybe others in the West kind of assume about safety and security.
Yeah, sure.
We're far more attuned to pick that up, maybe.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you know, and I'll note, actually, I saw, you know, I just want you to know, I'll be praying for you guys. I mean, I just saw an article that, you know, homicides are on the rise, you know, in 20 cities across the United States. So maybe it's you guys that are actually living in the danger, not me.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you saying that. I think one of the things I experienced largely with the people that we talked about before, the Religious Liberty Partnership, other Christians around the globe, and some other folks I've met internationally, and you've probably picked up on this too, is that we Americans want to often say we're praying for you,
right.
You know, and our international brothers and sisters say, no, please pray with us, because we pray for you too.
Exactly.
So I think you expressing that sentiment from your vantage point makes a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, no, that's true. You know, and
we appreciate it.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and one point of pride that Middle Eastern Christians, you know, sort of, you know, share unanimously is the idea that this is where Christianity started, was in the Middle East.
Yeah.
It came to America, not the other way around. And so in no way intended to, you know, to belittle missions work and those kinds of things. But I think one of my big takeaways from living here is realizing, you know, how much I actually did and still do believe that the United States is the center of the universe. And there's a lot of world out there. And, you know, certainly, you know, the U.S. plays an outsized role in terms of, you know, influencing the international agenda when it comes to a whole range of issues. But there are a lot of other countries as well,
right.
You know, that we ought to respect them and understand our place in a, you know, in a global society.
Well, Travis Wousseau, international man of mystery, thank you for your advocacy efforts on behalf of vulnerable people around the globe. And thank you for sharing your insights today with Canon and Culture.